Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Lynn Wilson. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Wilson is a professor of therapeutic radiology and an expert in the use of radiation to treat lung cancers and cutaneous lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Francine and Lynn welcome Dr. Ruth McCorkle for a conversation about cancer survivorship. Dr. McCorkle is Florence Shorsky Wald Professor of Nursing at the Yale School of Public Health. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about your role here, Ruth, and what you do at the Cancer Center.
I've been a nurse for almost 50 years and have a program of research where I study advanced practice nurses and how they have specific outcomes with patients and family members. And last year, I was appointed to be director of psychosocial oncology at the Yale Cancer Center. So my charge right now is trying to develop a psychosocial program at the Smilow Cancer Hospital.
Ruth, how did you become interested in these topics?
Well, I'm also personally a survivor. I had breast cancer over 22 years ago. My family, my father died of lymphoma, so as with most people, we have lots of personal and family experiences. But I studied to become an oncology nurse in 1967 after I got out of air evac with Vietnam. And I thought cancer would really give me an opportunity to establish relationships with patients. I had learned how to break bad news and had gotten actually too good at it, unfortunately. So it gave me that personal connection with patients, and cancer allowed me that opportunity to grow and learn.
Ruth, you mentioned that you're involved with advanced practice nurses. Could you let our audience know the difference between like a regular nurse and an advanced practice nurse?
Sure, that's a great question. Nursing actually is very confusing because nurses take the same degree of licensure to get their RN licensure. And most nurses now can be a two-year. There are also some schools that have diploma schools. And then their baccalaureate education with the bachelor's. I work with nurses that have a master's degree and they specialize in oncology. So they have extensive education in order to practice somewhat independently under a physician's supervision.
Is it relatively recently that we've had advanced practice nurses working with us?
Well, it came about in about the mid-60s, a nurse practitioner out of Rochester. Yale has actually been very committed to advanced practice since they started their school because we are only a master's program. We don't have an undergraduate. So that actually was one of the reasons why I came to Yale 12 years ago.
Ruth, I think people have a general sense or idea what survivorship means, but tell us what it means to you. What is it really all about?
Well, for a number of years, survivorship was only thought about those people who had a diagnosis and finished their treatment, and then after they completed their treatment, they were called a survivor, because it's a tough road to go through cancer treatment. But we've had a number of Institute of Medicine reports, and out of those, the common perception now is that a cancer patient at the time of diagnosis is a cancer survivor, because the goal is to help them survive the experience and live the best they can. And I think that's a good definition, and the general population, I don't think, has that understanding, and I think it gives people more hope to realize that we're all working on the same team to help them to survive.
Ruth, how would you differentiate the kinds of challenges that a cancer patient faces, say, while they're getting their treatment versus when they're finished with their treatment?
Well, we know there are particular times in the course of an illness in which people have more psychological distress than at other times. And these times are at the time of diagnosis, the time when treatment starts. But it's equally difficult when the treatment stops. Because during the treatment, patients and families have a lot of concentrated time with the providers. And after that stops, you're not seeing them as much. And even some are free of their cancer, and they're sort of encouraged to go back to their primary care doctor and then only see their physician maybe every 6 months or every year. And here they've been seeing them every week or every couple of weeks. And in radiation, you see them daily for 6 weeks. And so it's very difficult both times, actually, and you need to really plan for it. During the treatment, you have a lot of people helping you. You have the physician, you have the nurses, you have the social workers, so you have lots of support. But after the treatment, sometimes it's important to be plugged into systems like support groups and maybe even private counseling to sort of get back into work. Because one of the devastating side effects from cancer, no matter what your diagnosis, no matter what your treatment, is fatigue. And when you get really bone tired, sometimes you get depressed and you don't know whether you're going to get better or not, but they do get better. And often you just need encouragement to tell you, in fact, you're going to get better.
I'd be interested in some of your experience, Ruth, with this. With some of the patients I've treated who have done well, things for some patients went very well during their treatment course, and they got through it well, and their side effects weren't too bad. But then when things were done, and we had a very high chance of a cure for that patient, that survivor, I've seen some patients actually have a tremendous amount of anxiety, much more significant after the treatment's over than actually during the treatment program. I think this might be a little bit along the lines of what you said. All of a sudden, they're not coming to the team on a daily basis, maybe, you know, once every couple of months. And I think there's a lot of concern for patients regarding, is my cancer going to come back? What's our plan for monitoring me and that sort of thing? Have you seen that sort of experience in
patients?
I
have, and the real fears. One of the phenomenon, it doesn't happen to everybody, but we do know that post-traumatic stress syndrome does occur to people. And just if they've been away from the clinic and just walking through the double doors will bring back all of those fears and anxiety. And so those people really want to not go around. And so often I think returning to work, if people look different, if they have tracheostomies or if they've lost their hair. For myself, I have lymphedema, and you have to really learn on how to protect yourself from raking, shoveling snow like this morning. I mean, any little thing can upset you. And it's a matter of really learning what we call this now is self-management. And it is an area that we have to teach people really to reorganize and think through some of their. I'm working with people with ostomies right now in a clinical trial, and it's really fascinating to work with them. They want to travel, and you have to help them figure out where to drive, where the bathrooms are in case they have an accident. And they have incredible problem-solving abilities, but it's just helping them, joining in a partnership with them to think out what their day is like so they can figure out, so they're not embarrassed. And then they're willing to make those risks.
Ruth, when we see patients in the clinic, Lynn and I are other oncologists, and we're starting treatment on a patient, is there anything special that we should be doing to screen patients, to try to identify patients who perhaps might become more anxious during the course of treatment or even after treatment?
Well, there are a battery of psychological instruments. National Cancer Network Group came out with a guideline to use the emotional distress thermometer, which is goes from 0 to 10, and has a list of problems along it. And their recommendation is that you give this to people at every visit. Well, it's difficult because you have limited resources for people to check it. We're implementing this at Smilo Cancer Hospital now and using it in some clinics. We're actually doing it in the bone marrow area where you work, Francine, and we're doing it in the breast clinic, we're doing it in the GI clinic. And what we're trying to figure out right now is how frequently to give it, and who should be looking at it, and how to make the referrals to make sure that we have adequate resources. Our social workers at Smilo are phenomenal in responding to people's needs. The majority of patients and families get through cancer pretty good, and they have the resources with just a little bit of our help. Because nurses and physicians are extremely skilled in supporting people, but there are groups of patients who are at risk for problems. If you've had psychiatric problems before, cancer's not going to help it. So those people are at high risk. If you have genes that are in the family, the BRCA gene for either breast or ovarian, we also know those women are often hypervigilant about it, and they monitor themselves, and then they get cancer, and they feel like it's unfair. And so we know who some of those people are, but we don't know who they all are. So we all just have to be aware that people need assistance, and you have to ask them.
One of the things that actually came out in one of the little surveys that we did was that patients say that we're not asking them often enough whether or not they're depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really key point, and it's true that when we get busy and are attending to the physical aspects of what's going on, perhaps we do forget to ask often enough about the emotional aspects of the patient.
Well, and I also think that sometimes patients don't want to tell us. They have to have that stiff upper lip. And so I think the family member is sometimes the best informant in saying, how has this person been? When we see people on a daily basis, sometimes we get used to them and we don't see the changes. But when they come back at the 3-month visit, it becomes very apparent that they've changed. So, and I think that's true with family members. They often don't realize how people are deteriorating. And they need our help in seeing some of those cues.
I think another thing that is advantageous to the teams we have at Smilo and the multidisciplinary clinics, and I don't just mean different types of doctors tending to a patient, but I mean social workers, nurses, dietitians. A lot of times, Francine, as you mentioned, patient may be depressed, and it's something because I'm bogged down in the hands-on real medical aspects of their care, but one of my team members will bring something to my attention that I either didn't notice or was too focused on other things to pick up on. And so I think that's important. And it's one of the nice things we have here at Yale for patients is that there's a lot of different specialists associated with each team who, you know, are always trying to evaluate the patient from their area of expertise. And it can be very helpful and to a great advantage for patients, I think.
Well, that's why I like nursing, because I always feel like the nurse can be the hub and really help to coordinate all those services.
Can you talk a little bit also about some of the physical challenges? We talked about the psychological issues, but there are certainly a lot of physical challenges that survivors
face. Well, I think sleep. In my experience, patients don't have as much pain as we think they will afterwards. And patients are fearful of pain. And generally, pain is overrated, I think. But when a patient has pain, I think we need to really be sensitive to it. But it's the, as I said before, it's the fatigue. It really is. Women with breast cancer often are really out of sorts because they're gaining weight. And they're doing everything they can, and they feel like they're not eating, and yet here they are. And it really has to do with their metabolism and understanding that. We have a couple really good trials going on with Tish Knopp and Melinda Irwin on the role of exercise in these women. And we know that exercise is really healthy and beneficial and is not only effective in breast cancer patients, but other patients. We also have a really strong program to help people with smoking cessation with Ben Toll. And we know that if people make an effort to stop smoking while they're getting treatment, it will increase their appearance, it will increase their energy, it will increase their breathing. I mean, they just overall, and their family are elated that they're doing that.
We're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about cancer survivorship with Dr. Ruth McCorkle.
This year, over 200,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer, and in Connecticut alone, there will be over 2,000 new cases. More than 85% of lung cancer diagnoses are related to smoking, and quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Each day, patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care. New treatment options and surgical techniques are giving lung cancer survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer. An option for lung cancer patients in need of surgery at Yale Cancer Center is a video-assisted thoracoscopic surgery, also known as a VATS procedure, which is a minimally invasive technique. This has been a Medical Minute. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Lynn Wilson, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss, and our guest, Dr. Ruth McCorkle, and we're discussing cancer survivorship. Ruth, tell our listeners a bit about what sort of support families receive and how essential it is for family involvement, if possible, to support the cancer patient.
Well, families are neglected, I think, in cancer care. One of the dilemmas is about HIPAA, which requires that we have difficulty talking to some family members about cancer. But I think it's really important when a patient's diagnosis is given that a family member is present. And I think it's also important that the healthcare provider who gives the diagnosis also asks the patient who else they have to tell. Because when you're dealing with a diagnosis yourself, whether you have a background in cancer or whether it's new, it's really an existential experience. And to have to go home and start calling people to tell them what you're going through when you're trying to cope with it yourself is tremendously burdensome. So one of the things I think is important to families is that we are clear that someone else understands the diagnosis and wants to take on the burden of helping to tell the other members of the family. And I think we have a responsibility for that. It's difficult if the patient doesn't want anybody else to know. I know there are always special circumstances, but even in those circumstances, I think the patient needs to be brought back in a week or 2 weeks and or talked to on the phone so that you're still, if that's what the patient wishes. So once a patient is diagnosed, gets work up, and you plan on a treatment plan, no matter what that treatment is, whether it's surgery, radiation, a bone marrow transplant, that person's world's going to be turned upside down. And cancer treatment takes a lot of effort. And if we want it to be successful at home, we have to have family members help the patient because we're not in the home. Most of the time, we don't ask for other services like nursing care to come in the home to help them. And most patients and families have no idea what that care is going to entail. So those families, and they're very competent, But because, again, they too are in an existential crisis, their problem-solving skills, the patient, everybody's skills are taxed. And so we need to be sure that a caregiver, a family caregiver, is capable of providing the care, that we're not sending somebody home to ill people in the family. Often what happens to a person who gets a diagnosis of cancer, and about 40% of the time, they're taking care of somebody ill in their own home. If you put an ill patient in a home with an ill caregiver, they both do poorly. And my research shows that they both get admitted quicker within the 30 days than if you send some help home, whether it's professional help or not. So you have to find out if a caregiver is willing to provide the care. It's one thing to have a body in the home, but if the person says, you know, I just can't do it. So you have to have somebody who is healthy. You have to have somebody who's willing. You have to find out if they have any special skills that we can use to capitalize, if they've given medication before, they know how to give injections, if they know if they're a dietitian, whatever. A lot of people have skills. A lot of people have taken care of ill people before. And we have to make them the captain of the team. It's really boosting them up and teaching them how to do this. So you have to let them understand about the long haul of this. If you're going to get 6 weeks of radiation, it's a daily trip in. And it's not adding something on to your day. Oh, I'll stop by for an hour, get my radiation, and go on about my... I tell patients when I work with them, you're going to get this treatment. You have to give something up. It's not an add-on. It's not like we take a paper home at night and we read it in addition to what we have to do. You have to give something up during this period of time. And when you talk to them like this, they get it. They really get it. And then you have your team in place, and both the patient and the family caregiver feel good because they know they're doing something to help the patient.
I'm sure you've been in this situation before, but say you're with a patient, maybe for the first time, and they're alone, and you talk to them about family or family involvement, and maybe there are family members, but for whatever reason, the patient's not interested in either talking to them about it, having them there, wants them excluded. Have you been fairly successful in trying to get that patient to integrate their family so that they can have some of the help and advantages in getting through this that you've just reviewed?
Some patients are very independent, very private, do not want this, and sometimes they have to struggle. The important thing is to realize you're putting them in that category and that you monitor them carefully. I know when I was ill with my own head and neck cancer, you called me. I had never met you before. You gave me your cell phone number. You told me to call you anytime. I never called you, but I still have it in my cell phone on
Good.
Speed dial, but I mean, just to have that reassurance to know it because you were checking in with me is an incredible reassurance about somebody caring.
Ruth, I know that some patients don't have a family member, or perhaps they feel more comfortable with a friend. And there are certainly instances that I've seen where a person has identified a best friend, or also in some cases also a cancer survivor that they've met through,
yeah,
say, American Cancer Society, to come to them with them to their meetings.
Yes, they're very helpful. This buddy network and the rides through the American Cancer Society. But I think the important thing is to use a lot of resources during this period of time. Most people really think, well, I can get through this. It can't be that tough. But I think we really have to be more proactive in helping people. And usually when you have somebody there, you'll have a little, as a healthcare provider, understanding, you know, this person may have a little difficulty. So you want to bring the nurse in and say, let's see if we can coordinate some things for this patient.
In terms of that multidisciplinary team, you have the physician and the nurses. and also the social workers. Are there other people that get involved, such as the dietitians and the chaplains and other people as well?
Well, I think for our, again, I was diagnosed with head and neck cancer. I had a lesion on my tongue about 3 years ago. And the nurse manager there, Shelley Jolie, she had my hearing tested. She had me go to speech therapists. She had me go to a physical therapist to learn for swallowing in preparation for the I had to make a decision on what kind of treatment that I wanted, but whether I was going to do surgery. And she really helped me to try to figure out what all the consequences of the different kinds of treatment before I made a decision. And part of that was understanding what kind of resources I would need afterwards in rehabilitation to get some of the function back.
Ruth, could you talk to the listeners a little bit about some of the challenges and the effects of head and neck cancer treatment?
It's a really a devastating cancer. It's for years has been associated with sort of unhealthy behavior like smoking and drinking and there's sort of these stereotypes. And so when people who don't get this, who don't have those unhealthy behaviors get it, we now also know that it's also associated with some of the viruses. So then you worry about some of your sexual practices. I mean, so all these things go through your mind as to why did you get this sort of awful disease. So it really is, again, I've been talking about the existential plight about when you get it, am I going to live or die? And we know that lasts for about 100 days in which you sort of get your senses back and realize that this is going to kill you, but it is going to make you different than what you were before. And I was very fortunate. Again, we know that people who have cancers that are unusual, they should ask for second opinions and really come to a cancer comprehensive center. We're the only cancer comprehensive center in the state, and it's important to get people who do the treatment and understand the diagnosis on an everyday basis, that they don't have a case once a year, but they see people with these kinds of cancers three or four or half a dozen a week. And my cancer was unusual. I have a adenoid cystic, which is, and you think about adenoids and tonsils, and it's a very slow-growing cancer. So the usual kind of chemotherapy and radiation is not necessarily sensitive to it. So I was very fortunate that we have Dr. Roy Decker here, and he has an MD and a PhD and has done some really groundbreaking research and understanding how to treat my cancer. I went to Seattle and Dana-Farber and Iowa to get worked up, and I came back here because of his expertise, and I chose to have radiation therapy. And I have to admit, one of the things that happens with radiation, they have to devise a technique so you get treated every day, and they want to treat you in the exact same spot. So they have to do a lot of calculation about the tumor. But in order to keep you in position, they have to put a metal mask over your face and actually clamp it to the table. And sometimes that treatment can last 5 to 10 minutes. And when you're in that position, it's really quite scary going through it. And there are medications for it, Ativan and some other things. But one of the things that I felt was the most helpful to me, I had a doctoral student at the time, who Anna Lyle Williams, who was into meditation. And she really taught me to meditate and go through my meditation mantras to get through my radiation. And between her and Roy and the medication, I really did sail through it. I lost weight, and my skin was irritated, and I had a sore throat. But I was very lucky to have the team that I did. And right now, the cancer is very well controlled, and I'm very fortunate.
Dr. Ruth McCorkle is Florence Shorsky Wald Professor of Nursing at the Yale School of Public Health. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.